Is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Larkin, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. I got the trick chair today. There we go. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for this January 17 session of oral arguments. We have four cases on our oral calendar today. The first case is State of Minnesota versus Rote. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel, and you can use that time for rebuttal if you like. There is a button in the middle of the lectern. You can raise or lower it to your convenience. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions. Do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep an audio recording of the proceedings. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Andrew Wilson. I represent the appellant, Matthew Rote. Counsel. Your honors, I'd like to focus my prepared remarks on the first issue that we raised in our written submission, which is the issue of competency of J.R., older of the two complaining witnesses. The other issues, I believe, are resolved through a concession from respondent's counsel, and so the only issue before the court remaining, I believe, is the first issue that appellants raised. Under Minnesota Statute 595.02, parent N, children are not competent witnesses unless they have the capacity to remember and relate facts truthfully.
Just to be clear, you don't dispute that we have a plain error standard on this issue today?
Your Honor, I'm happy to address plain error, but I think to a certain extent this might be structural error in that it implicates confrontation, and the idea of putting a potentially incompetent witness on the stand does not vindicate the right to confrontation. So I think that structural error may be an appropriate analysis.
Well, but even if you have a constitutional claim, those claims can be waived if they're not raised.
Certainly, and I'm happy to address plain error, Your Honor.
Thank you.
There's a two-part analysis under Section 595.02, and the first is that the child must have the capacity to tell the truth. And in Syme, this court interpreted that language, the telling the truth, to be a two-part analysis. First, the child must have the ability to be truthful, but they also must have the ability to appreciate the nature and obligations of the oath. The second part of the analysis is that the child must have the ability to recall facts. And the statute itself is plural, facts plural, not facts singular. And that really is the heart of the problem here. It's that the district court's competency evaluation ultimately disclosed that J.R. was able to recall a single fact, not facts, that he was able to relate truthfully. What ultimately happened...
What do you mean when you say that he was only one fact he could identify truthfully?
When the district court turned to the second component of the analysis, Your Honor, and asked J.R., do you know the difference between a truth and a lie? He said yes. Saying yes is different than demonstrating that you actually know the difference between a truth and a lie.
But he did know the difference between whether it was snowing outside, whether that was a truth or a lie.
Which is one fact. The other fact was a question as to whether or not his favorite sports team had ever won the Super Bowl, and he got that wrong.
Well, how is an 11-year-old supposed to know? I mean, he probably just didn't have an awareness versus thinking that's a lie versus a truth.
Certainly, Your Honor. And ultimately, even if you disregard that question, all you're left with is one fact. Is it snowing outside? And the question I think the court needs to answer, or at least wrestle with, is whether or not there's a materiality requirement for a competency evaluation. Certainly, you could ask the child to recall his name, but recalling a name has no bearing on whether you have the ability to tell the truth and recall facts in a way that would make it an important part of the analysis for is this child competent to testify. There has to be some level of materiality. And recalling the fact, is it snowing outside? I don't know if this courtroom had windows, but at best, JR was recalling walking into court that morning and saying what the weather was like outside. That's it. What bearing does that have on his ability to then testify about something that happened 6 years prior? And when you look at the trial transcript...
Are you suggesting that the test for competency would require the court to ask a truth or false statement about something that occurred years before in order to determine competency?
I think that would be part of the analysis, certainly.
Is there any case that supports that theory?
The fact, not a case, Your Honor, but Section 595.02 talks about recalling facts. The idea of recalling something necessarily implicates something that happened in the past.
Right. So, but my question is, you're suggesting that the past must refer to something substantially in the past as opposed to something recently in the past, and I'm wondering if there's some case law or other rule of law that would lead us to agree with that proposition.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but we're dealing with a delayed reporting case. So certainly when the court is determining whether or not this witness is competent to testify today, knowing that it's a delayed reporting case by 6 years, you have an 11-year-old, when the alleged offense occurred, they were five, certainly that becomes relevant. This witness is testifying about things that allegedly happened, complicated, arguably traumatic things that happened 6 years prior when they're a five-year-old. Don't you think that the district court should take it upon themselves to ask some more questions?
Is there a case that you were able to locate that would indicate that the rule requirement, the term, the plural facts, requires multiple facts to be explored rather than just one? Were you able to find a case where reversal has resulted as following a district court's failure to explore more than one fact?
No, Your Honor.
Then how would we say that the district court, if it erred, was plain in its error?
Because it's a plain reading of 595.02. There's an S at the end of the word fact that necessarily turns it into a plural. So the district court can't, I mean, in reading that statute, you can't just disregard the fact that the legislature included plural facts. And it makes sense that facts would be something that, you know, facts rather than fact is what the district court should be analyzing. Because the idea is you're intending to establish that this witness will be competent, which in turn implicates confrontation.
The problem I'm having with your argument, and I understand the argument that we should review for plain error, but there are some issues that are very difficult to evaluate for plain error, like evidentiary things like hearsay objections that people don't make, not giving them the opportunity to the other side to argue that there are exceptions to the hearsay rule that would apply. I'm troubled here by the fact that your client didn't challenge competency, that the district court really undertook this assessment on its own volition. Repeatedly asked both sides, are you satisfied? Do you have any questions you want to ask? Do you have any objection to me deciding this was a competent witness? How do we really get to a determination here of plain error under these circumstances?
Your Honor, I think the problem arose during the trial testimony itself. So the evaluation had been concluded, and I agree that defense counsel at the trial didn't object, and I agree that opposing counsel didn't object, and the trial court found competency prior to testimony. But once JR took the stand, he was effectively non-responsive. And so at that point, that's when the plain error should have applied, where the district court should have said, hold on, wait a second, what's going on here?
Does that reflect the competence or reflect the difficulty of the testimony that this 11-year-old victim was being asked to share publicly?
I think that's exactly the point. We don't know. I don't know if that is a reflection of the child being incompetent to testify or potentially having just been told to tell the truth under oath for the first time, having the oath administered, whether or not he was telling the truth and refusing to implicate Rote in this. He'd never been sworn before. The forensic testimony wasn't ever sworn. Conversations with his mother were never sworn. If, in fact, he was a competent witness, then the moment that the district court judge said, do you promise to tell the truth, and he said yes, took the stand, he didn't implicate Mr. Rote. So I think that's exactly the problem. That's why a remand is necessary, not a reversal. I don't know if this witness is competent or incompetent.
Is it your view that the district court is always required to undertake a competency review before receiving the testimony of an 11-year-old child if there's no objection?
No.
So if I understand your argument correctly, you're saying even though the district court was not obligated to inquire of the 11-year-old before that testimony was received, the district court creates an error by not applying the test that the court uses thoroughly enough. Is that what you're saying?
Sort of.
So if the district court doesn't have an obligation, I'm trying to understand why, if the district court doesn't have an obligation to engage in a competency inquiry at all, what would be the, without any request for it, what would be the basis for us saying, well, if you do, you have to do it with more extensively than you did?
Because the district court did conduct a competency evaluation in this case, and 595.02 says that if competency is evaluated, here are the things you need to look for. So the district court opened the door to its own error by engaging in a competency review. It's not like the district court can make a finding that a witness is incompetent be insulated from the requirements of 595.02. There's no determination one way or another if the district court, you know, if ultimately the district court said, look, JR, we want to put you on the stand to see whether or not you're going to be a competent witness. And he simply says, state your name for the record. He says, my name is JR. Okay, competent witness. And then JR gets on the stand and says absolutely nothing. Isn't there a question there? Isn't there a question whether or not the competency evaluation was enough to uncover, to resolve the issue that the district court raised itself, saying, you know, I think that there's an issue of competence here. I want to protect myself for purposes of appeal, potentially. But then the questions asked don't do enough to actually get to the heart of the issue. And the heart of the issue is, can this witness provide enough to get to the threshold of confrontation? And here, the witness couldn't. The witness was asked numerous questions about what happened, and at best, JR identified these allegations as it, couldn't provide any further detail. Respondent even appears to concede that this conviction was the product of the forensic interview being introduced.
Well, didn't JR, by way of nodding and otherwise making, I know, short statements, acknowledge that he had told his mom, that he had told the forensic interviewer, you know, what had happened, and that there is limited testimony identifying your client as the person who did the bad thing to him?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think to a certain extent you're right, but if you look directly to the transcript, in terms of telling your mom, the question was, do you remember telling your mom about it a while ago? There's a nonverbal nodding of a head. What is it? Earlier in that transcript, the prosecutor asked, I asked you earlier why you were here, and you said you kind of knew. Is that right? Nodding head, nonverbal response. Is one of those reasons to talk about appellant? Nodding head, nonverbal response. Was that a yes? Uh-huh. Well, to talk about what? In terms of the, he did a bad thing to me, what did you tell your mom was the question. And he said, he did bad stuff to me. It's not he did bad stuff to me, it's what did you tell your mom? I told my mom he did bad stuff to me. That comports with the nature of the obligation of the oath. He's still telling the truth. I told my mom that this happened. It doesn't mean that this happened. It means I told my mom that that happened. That's what the prosecutor asked. And then later in that transcript, is it what you had told your mom before? Nodding head, nonverbal response. And then
that's in response to the question, what kind of bad stuff did he do? Right? He had the nonverbal response, and so the question was, I see you're shaking your head. It's hard to talk about. Yeah. Is it what you had told your mom before? Doesn't that follow the what kind of bad stuff did he do question?
Well, what kind of bad stuff did he do?
Well, clearly the child was not comfortable discussing it in trial. That's very clear. But why doesn't the reference to tying it to what he in fact had told his mother before sufficient to implicate your client?
Your Honor, ultimately, I think there's enough ambiguity here that there's a real question as to what he's talking about. He did bad stuff to me. He did it. I told my mom about it. I mean, in conjunction with the forensic interview, sure, but what we're talking about is a right to confrontation. How is any defense attorney supposed to cross-examine that child when you're asking questions about, well, what happened? Nonverbal response. I mean, how are you supposed to get to the details? How are you supposed to get to the facts of what actually happened? So I think ultimately it's a
confrontation. Well, there was cross-examination.
There was cross-examination, Your Honor, and certainly...
And the opportunity to ask, to press the issue of it. I mean, it in context, I suppose, it might seem to some, and apparently to the jury, obvious what it meant. And if there was a doubt, there was an opportunity. Again, looking at the plain error challenge that you're making, there's certainly an opportunity for defense counsel to create some ambiguity as to what it meant. But defense counsel didn't do that.
I agree. Your Honor, I think that the opportunity for cross-examination is important for the court to consider. Because if truly this was an incompetent witness, simply having a body on the stand it is an opportunity for cross-examination, but not a material one, not a meaningful one.
Can I go back to the heart of your competency challenge, that there's only one question about one fact? The rule requires the district court to determine the witness's ability to recall facts. I'm trying to understand why you believe that in order to determine whether a person can recall facts requires multiple facts to be presented in the competency evaluation.
Your Honor, how do you demonstrate that you can recall facts if you can simply recall one fact?
Why wouldn't that be enough for the district court to conclude that the witness is able to recall? If you can recall one fact, why isn't that a demonstration that you can recall multiple facts?
Because he couldn't recall multiple facts. He demonstrated that.
No, I mean, end of the test, just as a matter of semantics under the test.
Yeah, and Your Honor, my answer is simply that the language of the test says facts.
Well, the test doesn't say you must ask multiple facts. The test is you have to test the witness to determine whether, in the judge's mind, the witness can recall facts, plural. I'm wondering why exploring about one fact isn't enough to allow you to reach that conclusion as a matter of logic.
As a matter of logic, I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Yes. You may still answer.
I'm going to fall back on the plain language of the statute, Your Honor, that it requires facts. I don't think logically you can demonstrate that you have the ability to recall multiple facts by simply answering one pretty basic question truthfully.
Well, would a judge be able to be confident that a witness could recall 10 facts if the judge only asked about two facts?
I think it's a case-by-case analysis.
No, I mean, just as a matter of semantics, you seem to be suggesting that there has to be some parallel between the number of facts that the judge is satisfied the witness can answer. It can only be established if you ask about that number of facts
I don't think there's a specific number, except I think it's more than one because it's plural. So it needs to be at least two.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lisa Lodine. I'm an assistant attorney general representing the state of Minnesota, and we are the respondent in the instant case. I'd like to make two main points here for the court in regards to addressing plain error. It does have to be error that is plain. So this is a standard beyond regular abuse of discretion error that's taken on. This does have additional meaning by being put in the plain error context.
Does the possibility of the error, if there was one, being structural, change that?
Well, first of all, this wasn't litigated, so the appellant has not put forward any support for the idea that this issue falls under structural error. Structural error is extremely limited and is only found both in the state courts and nationally in a very few number of situations. And just because he's claiming a confrontation clause problem doesn't raise structural error.
No, I understand that, but as a hypothetically,
okay,
if we were to agree with appellant that if there is an error, the type of error is structural, does that change the approach we take to the plain error analysis?
Well, structural errors do have a presumption of prejudice. So, yes, I mean, here, under plain error analysis, there's
would that
four.
Would that change whether we have to determine whether there was, in fact, an error and whether the error was plain?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know the answer to the distinction between error and error that was plain for a structural error. I don't know the answer to that question. The second point I'm going to want to address during my arguments here is that nothing in the record goes to show that this child was actually incompetent. Sure, he didn't answer a lot of questions at testimony. Sure, the judge could have done a better job asking questions in the preliminary exam. But in terms of plain error and prejudice, when you look back, there is nothing in the record that shows that this child testified falsely, didn't understand the questions, couldn't be a competent witness. Now, I'd like to go to one of the points that was raised earlier.
The judge has the prerogative to suspect possible incompetence and then to inquire. And if the judge does so, the judge must inquire with a thorough competency exam. I think that's the argument.
Right. That is wrong. And here's why it's wrong. So appellant wants to focus really strictly on the language of 595 subdivision 1N. So the subdivision 1N for children, which, by the way, we claim doesn't apply because this is not a child under 10, and subdivision 1N very clearly under its plain language only applies to children under 10. The determination of competency starts with a presumption. That is both the general presumption under subdivision 1, period, for adults and anyone who doesn't meet an exception, but even under 1N, the child under 10 is competent unless the court finds these things. And so that presumption does not go away unless and until incompetence is proven sufficiently. So the judge chose to engage in some voir dire. Nothing the judge asked overcame that presumption of competence. Sure, it wasn't entirely thorough. Of course, the 11-year-old could have had trouble answering whether the Vikings had won the Super Bowl or knowing for sure what team Tom Brady played on.
No one should have difficulty knowing whether the Vikings had won. That would show incompetence, I think.
But those questions and the answers to those questions did not raise incompetence. And unless and until the judge comes to a conclusion of incompetence, the presumption applies.
So how do you respond to appellant's argument that during the midst of trial, when it became clear that J.R. was not being a responsive witness and was having difficulty testifying to the relevant material facts, that in and of itself created a situation where the district court should have examined the competency issue again?
So not being willing to answer the questions is not about competency. There are women rape victims. There are adult men, who suffer assault and other issues. There are plenty of witnesses who come up, take the oath, sit there, and refuse to really engage in thorough answers to the questions, whether it's shame, embarrassment, fear of the defendant who's sitting there. That does not go to competency. That goes to credibility. And as the court has noted, the witness was there, and the witness sat there for cross-examination, and And that's what's required under the Confrontation Clause, and that's what happened. And had every ability and right to engage in a longer cross-examination, should he have chosen, to engage the child in more topics, should he have chosen, and to argue that as thoroughly on the credibility issue as appellant's counsel wanted in the closing. So we do have to draw that distinction between willingness to testify and competency to testify. And there really is, when you go look at the record here, including at the time of testimony, there isn't an indication that the child was lying. There isn't an indication that the child was confused. There is clear testimony that he was afraid, that he was nervous, that he couldn't talk about it. But that doesn't mean he's not competent. And so he also, did not really answer a number of questions. Instead, he did nonverbal shaking of his head. There were also some answers to questions that were, I don't know. But those do not actually negate the idea of competency. In fact, those support competency. This child, upon testimony, was being honest and upfront when he did not know the answer to questions. So as an example, defense counsel on cross-examination was asking him about riding his bike, and defense counsel used the term, do you do tricks? And the witness sat there and said, yeah, tricks. And then he came back right away and he goes, well, actually, I just do jumps. Okay, this kid is he's heard, he's testified, but he's not going to lie. He's not going to puff up what he's done. He's going to be clear. I just do jumps. Defense counsel tried to ask him, have you caught a really big catfish? He's like, no, it was my brother. And then he thinks about it and he clarifies, actually, it was my brother's best friend. This child is not unable to answer the questions that are not involving abuse. These other questions do not bring up incompetency. They bring up a child who's willing to think about the answers, correct the answers.
So just in context, if I understand this phase of your argument, you're speaking to the prejudice prong of the plain error test.
Yes. Yes, I'm sorry, right. That there's no ultimate prejudice because of the fact that this, that's true, Your Honor, but actually I step back and I go to, clear error as well because.
The argument of error, I think, if I understand it right, goes to the quality of the test that the judge was engaging in to inquire about competence. I think that's the error that has been alleged, that there was not a robust enough competency examination under the statute.
One of the statutes that appellant counsel has not mentioned is 595.06, and that is the statute that advises what the questions could be on examining the capacity of the witness. So it includes this two-prong test or analysis. But if you go to that statute, it gives the judge authority and it indicates permissible examination. Now, since this child was not actually covered under Subdivision 1N, under Subdivision 1, the child is a competent witness if he has substantial understanding. That does not require the court to go conduct this. There's no case law. There's nothing that indicates that when you have a presumed competent witness who's the standard of which is substantial understanding, that a judge has to even go through the two prongs. It could be that this examination was going on and the judge is like, this kid, this child, this victim, he knows the here and now. In fact, he sort of asked the court, do you know where we are today? You know, and the kid's like, yeah, we're in the courtroom. And asked further questions. And this judge had to find that this child, to be competent, this child over the age of 10 had substantial understanding. And under 595.06, which allows him to inquire into the capacity, all of the language of which is permissive and not mandatory, he did what the judge did. It's consistent. There's no inconsistency with the statutes, which is what appellant's counsel is trying to point out. There's no cases, but look at the plain language of the statute.
In the case of a child over 10, if there were an objection to the child's competency, do you agree that the judge then perhaps would have some obligation to question the child to ensure competency?
Absolutely. But here, the judge is doing this on his own, and...
Well, do you concede that multiple questions of fact are necessary to conclude or determine whether a witness can recall facts, plural?
No. One of the things we have going on here is, since there's no test or requirement or minimum questioning that's required in this case, the judge can look at the entire examination, all of the witnesses' answers, and the judge can make inferences from these answers. And the totality, you know, this is a discretionary action by the judge. This is a discretionary decision by the judge to allow the witness to testify. And this judge has, you know, a couple of pages of testimony, and the judge has apparently made the decision to allow him to testify, but offers that opportunity, and no one challenges that the witness is incompetent. So the totality of what the judge had done convinced the judge there's no problem with this child being a competent witness, and no one challenged him otherwise. How can it be plain error for a judge under these circumstances to not go further? There was no reason to go further. And certainly, had an objection been raised, both the court and the prosecution would have furthered the inquiry to make sure it was established sufficiently. But we were sort of prohibited or prejudiced by not doing that because there was no objection. Some law that I do want to point out to this court is that, you know, the district...
You should know that your time is expired.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If you're beginning a new line, you might want to rest on your briefs.
Okay. Yes, we will rely on our briefs. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, could you address an issue for me? What law says that you seem to be relying on the test under 595.02 subdivision 1 and on this notion of must be able to recall facts? What law says that test applies when determining the competency of a child over 10?
Parent F of the same statute, Your Honor. It deals with individuals of unsound mind. We cited that on page 21 of our principal brief.
Why can't a judge infer from a witness's ability to recall one fact the witness's ability to recall multiple facts?
Your Honor, respondent argued to this court that it's a totality of the circumstances analysis based on all of the questions that the district court asks and the answers received during the competency evaluation. To a certain extent, I agree. So if the court's not going to be holding that multiple facts are required despite the plural language, then look at the totality of what happened here.
No, go to my question, though. Why wouldn't a judge be able to infer from a witness's ability to recall one fact the witness's ability to recall other facts?
I think it depends on the fact. How is, if the question asked to a witness is...
Well, let's just not talk about quality. Let's talk about quantity. Your argument was about quantity because of the way the noun is framed in the statute, facts. Why wouldn't a judge be able to infer from a witness's ability to recall one fact the witness's ability to recall multiple facts?
Maybe you can. Our argument was both about quality and quantity. The quantity is the plural facts. That's the second part of the analysis. The quality is about the ability to relay facts truthfully. So that's why it's a totality of the circumstances analysis. And respondent is arguing that you need to look at the entire examination. I agree. JR knew his age.
Can we go to the prejudice part of it? Let's assume you're correct. If you look at the testimony, it seems to me that the child responded. The child's responses were congruent with the questions asked. There wasn't a delusional responses. There wasn't sort of a child going astray. Witnesses answering, weaving around that would call into question, based upon the testimony, the call into question the child's competency. Except your point about it, which I think the state has responded to.
I think there's more than that, Your Honor. The very first question that was asked of JR once he took the stand was, do you know why you're in court today? He said, kind of. They said, why is that? The court inquired, did you understand the question? He said, yeah. Okay, are you able to tell us? Not really. That goes to competency. Do you know why you're in court? Not really. Kind of, but not really. Well, why? No response. So that's one. This also goes to the indication of confusion that the respondent's counsel was arguing about. Do you remember what happened? Some of it. Apart from separating that from the question about what it means, do you remember it? Some.
I mean, if I asked you, do you remember what you were doing last night, and you said, I remember some of it, that wouldn't suggest that you're not competent. That would suggest that you remember some but not all. Why isn't that just a reflection on how the human mind works? Everybody's human mind, competent witnesses' minds.
Isn't the question about can this witness relay facts truthfully?
Right, but the proof that you just offered was that the witness testified that I can recall some but not all. Why isn't that a reflection of competence rather than incompetence?
Your Honor, maybe a better example would be later in the transcripts when JR is asked the question, do you think the way you remember it now is exactly how it happened, or do you think some of it you just don't remember so much? And all he said was, it happened, but. But what? It happened, but not the way I meant?
But I don't want to talk about it.
Potentially, Your Honor. But isn't that enough to trigger some sort of analysis or an obligation for a further analysis by the district court to ensure that the jury is being presented with a witness that is competent to answer these questions? It happened, but. That's all it says. But what?
Counsel, I have two questions for you, if I may. I'm trying to go back to subdivision 7 on my small phone where I'm looking at Westlaw. And you cited to parent F, persons of unsound mind. Do you have any case that says... Do you allege the witness was of unsound mind? And if so, why? I'm looking at the annotations for that, and they talk about people diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. Do you have anything other than the 11-year-old's age as a basis to allege unsound mind such that this subparagraph applies?
We know that there was a learning disability. We know that there was an IEP. We know that the child was 11 years old talking about something that happened with 5, and then the totality of the circumstances given his testimony at trial. I think together...
So you think unsound mind equates with a learning disability when case law describes it as schizophrenia or other serious mental health diagnoses?
I think there's a world in which it would.
Okay. Let me ask you this. I'm trying to imagine how this plays out. So you're in trial. Child is on the stand. Child is sort of shutting down, which is not unusual in these cases. what you're proposing is the district court sort of what, recess the trial, taken the witness back and done then a competency evaluation and then brought the witness back before the jury?
That's one way to handle it, certainly.
How would that have looked to the jury?
I think there's a way where the district court could have done it without any sort of prejudice to either party, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen, the jury, we're going to take a 5-10 minute recess here. You know, go get a drink of water, come back. That happens with some regularity during criminal trials.
I'm a little worried about what it might signal to the jury if it was occurring right at the same time that the victim witness was not answering questions. So, I mean, incumbent upon the defense to raise the issue.
I agree, and that's why it is a plain error review. There was no objection.
But, I mean, we have to say, like, also somebody who was a district court judge and public defender for a long time, the judge is concerned about messing with the defense's case. And quite frankly, if I were the judge and I saw this happening, I might think this is going very well for the defense. The child's not producing any incriminating evidence. You know, should I really interrupt the trial when no one's objecting and get involved with competency when no one is challenging it? I mean, you're asking a lot of the district court judge.
I agree.
Which wouldn't have to be asked if the defense had merely objected, and the failure to object was probably strategic given how things were going. So why does the defense get another bite at the apple, which is one of the concerns about the plain error doctrine?
Your Honor, I'm not sure it was strategy given the questions that the defense counsel asked during cross-examination, knowing what happened during the direct examination. If I were defense counsel, I would have rested immediately upon the closure of the state's case related to this witness. So I'm not sure it was a strategic decision. I think the district court could have simply called counsel up to the bench to see whether or not there was an issue, alerted it to the parties, and then maybe that would have triggered an objection, maybe it wouldn't have.
And if it hadn't, would you still then be here arguing that this error was involved in the district court?
I think plain error would still apply, but I think we have a much weaker argument, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. Difficult case, obviously, on the law, and especially under the facts, very troubling circumstances, and we will obviously take that into account, but make our decision based upon the law. Thank you for your briefs and your oral argument today. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Matter submitted.